And we're live with episode 39 of the Wake Up Podcast. And on today's show, I've got Colin, aka Heavily Armed Clown, and Ben Prentice on the show with me, the boys who founded What the Fuck Happened in 1971. I was about to say I shouldn't swear, but fuck that. And Ben, who's now working for working with Pete McCormack over at What Bitcoin Did. Gentlemen, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us, brother. Good to be here.
Sure. For sure. It's been almost a year since we last caught up, right? When I came on yours, yeah?
Yeah, I think so. And yeah, you were one of the last guests we had, actually.
Oh, really? So you guys aren't running the show anymore?
Well, it's not a bull market pod, you know?
Touche. It's that's actually a good point to start on. You guys have been around the block for a little bit. What do you guys see as the differentiators between what things are like during bull markets, what things are like during bear markets? The richness of the discourse or the shallowness of the discourse. Like, talk to me on that point. I'm curious to sort of see what you guys view from both your vantage points.
Yeah, it's clear to me now. It's funny because I heard people talk about it I got in on the bear market basically, beginning of 2018. And There was a lot of signal to noise, but it's funny because I heard people talk about what it's like, oh, nobody can focus in a bull market. In a bull market, everything's profitable. Anybody who's talking about Bitcoin or crypto or NFTs, man, everyone wants to hear it, dude. And everyone wants to buy it. It doesn't matter, right? And I think that's, where you get these insane hype waves, and you see the NFTs are going to insane valuations way beyond anything that they would be worth, even if they weren't worthless tokens, which they are. I've even seen it on my Twitter feed recently. It's like, there's less content and there's more just like price talk and stuff. And it's kind of sad, but I guess you kind of understand that there's a lot of champagne popping and every once in a while you got to join in a little bit.
Yeah, interesting. And what about, so I guess that's on Twitter at least. What about outside of Twitter, like in day-to-day life? Like, have you sort of, has it reached the stage where you guys are like the Uber driver and shit like that, or friends and family maybe hitting you up? Like where is it sort of at there?
It's funny, these things tend to go in circles. Like I was expecting a lot more people to be hitting me up like, oh dude, you were so right, I need Bitcoin, what do I need to know? But instead it's kind of like, oh man, you were right about Bitcoin, I wish I had gotten in on it. When are you cashing out? And it's just like, dude, no, you still don't get it. And I think too, like a lot of it, like we see in the bear market, you don't so much have like these intellectuals coming in and pushing their credentials around and saying, well, listen to me, I can tell you what's wrong with Bitcoin, which like, we're seeing a lot of right now with like the Weinsteins and the people coming in who just think that they're God's gift to the intellectual fabric of any group. Just because they know theoretical physics, they think that they can tell you about, econ and game theory and computer programming and whatever, regardless of what they know about those topics in and of themselves. There's like this metaverse of Bitcoin that they haven't explored and they don't understand the subtle nuances. And you don't see that in the bear market. Like, you don't see these guys just like show up because there's no real reason. Like, if they're not already into it because they were sucked in by the monetary economics or just by the technology, now they're here because numbers go up and everyone's talking about it.
Yeah, I think you touched on a really interesting point there for me. And I obviously tweeted about it the other day, and like it's that I'm here to fix Bitcoin derangement syndrome. It's, I don't know shit about what I'm fucking talking about, but I'll come in like Miley Cyrus on a wrecking ball and I'll tell you guys what's wrong with what you're doing, despite it having worked for 12 years. I'll sort of, go back out and go back to my theoretical intellectual sophistry.
Well, but it's getting to the point.
Call you guys mean.
It's getting to the point where like everybody needs to have kind of a Bitcoin take, I think. I think when Elon Musk comes in like a wrecking ball and makes it a global conversation, people, you know, I mean, sorry, Eric, but we're trashing on you today. Like, I know Eric listens to your pod, obviously, Alex. So Eric comes in and he's like, well, I'm the smartest man in the world. So I definitely, you know, have to have my own take on it. And obviously that take is not nuanced and not well-researched. And, you know, he just comes in and says, hey, it needs, you know, privacy on the base layer, or it needs to create its own gauge field or something like that. So yeah, everyone has to have a take though. And I think you're going to increasingly see some of those people realize that their takes are not nuanced enough and are not well-researched enough. And I think that will continue.
What
Eric was an interesting one for me because, sorry, dude, I'll throw it to you in a sec. I was just going to say, Eric's an interesting one because Peter Thiel, who he works for, fucking actually gets Bitcoin. Like, I think his framing of, and he did this years ago where he framed on one side, you know, this idea of the rise of AI as the promise of the central planning, you know, model of the world, and Bitcoin as the one that is, you know, more libertarian. Decentralized. And I think that framing is about as spot on as you can get from a macro point of view, between what Bitcoin represents in the world and what traditional centralized sort of technologies represent. And, you know, I mean, I don't know whether Weinstein's fucking tone deaf or what the case is, but like, it's, you know, he's sort of gotten one of the, like, someone who genuinely gets it right next to him that he doesn't seem to have heard. So it's, you know, I find that strange. But what were you going to say, Colin?
Well, two lines of thought. First, I'll talk about the Weinstein thing. You know, he's been on our DMs, right? Because he's noticed our website. It's drawn his attention in the past. And, you know, I won't like really go into any specifics about what was discussed, but like he mentioned our website on Ted Cruz's podcast. And one day I was like, holy crap, why did we just get 12,000 hits on the website? And it was just because he was just talking to Ted Cruz, and it was actually a great conversation. Like, I think Weinstein is a very smart guy. I really do. But he doesn't get Bitcoin yet because he hasn't traversed the nuance necessary to understanding, you know, why it works and why it's useful and why it's important. The other thing that I was going to say, well, yeah, he blames like 1971 phenomenon, which is obviously a monetary phenomenon to anyone who knows. He blames that on, like, I think research and development funding or something, like scientific research funding or something ridiculous, like something like a second order effect of a soft money, which is what you see time and time and time again. Ben and I were just talking about this earlier today. People constantly attribute these second order effects to the causes of these shifts in monetary paradigms. They look and like they blame the internet, or they blame technology, they blame computers, they blame cultural changes in society. And all of those things are downstream of economic policy. And the other thing that I was going to say was just like tangentially related, but I had a neighbor over the other day, and, you know, him and I got to talking, and I let him kind of lead in with like what investments he was into. And he was telling me about his Stellar Lumens pick. And I'm just like, well, but why do you value that? And he couldn't really give me an answer. You know, I was like, well, I only buy Bitcoin. He's like, yeah, but Bitcoin already went up. So like, you already got yours. And like, I need to buy Stellar Lumens right now because it's still cheap. And you know, like I'm not trying to disparage him because we love our pre-coiners, right? Like, we want to encourage them to learn and dig deeper in the rabbit hole. And that's kind of where you all start, where we all started, was like just kind of saying, hey, well, what is this? I don't know. It's valuable. It looks valuable. I'll buy this coin because people are talking about it. But it's not hard to poke hole in that logic. You somebody who's intellectually honest, you only have to ask them a couple questions before they're like, well, I don't know. Why do I value Stellar Lumens? Like, I have no idea.
That's, I was literally writing some notes here and I wanted to pull on this thread. So Ben, you said you sort of got in around the 2018, early 2018 when the bear market sort of kicked in.
Yeah.
Colin,
yeah.
What was your sort of entry point?
About the same, like late 2017. Okay. Yeah. And I came in because I just saw a number was going up, and it just so happened that I was like, oh wow, this actually answers all of the things I've been reading about with Hayek and Ron Paul and, you know, the creature from Jekyll Island and all that stuff. And I was like, oh, this is like a perfect fit. This is exactly what we need.
Okay, interesting. Because so did you guys have WTF happen in 1971 running before you got into Bitcoin, or was that after?
Oh, way after. It came from research that we were doing on monetary history, and just kept finding all these charts. So it's like, wow, this is kind of undeniable. It's funny because it's the same conclusion that Eric Weinstein comes to. His entire podcast is about our website, right?
So this for me, I find really intriguing is, I mean, I was probably a year before you guys, or maybe 2 years before you guys. I was kind of like mid 2016, and it was the same thing for me. Like, I got in because number go up. It was actually a degenerate junkie friend of mine who was, buying shit on the dark net, who re-mentioned Bitcoin to me and was like, talking to me about how his friend made all this money on this thing called Bitcoin. And I was like, fuck, I've heard about that before. And I remember sort of, it was like Max Keiser jumping up and down on a couch in like 2012 or something. And, you know, I kind of at that point just dismissed it. I was, you know, buying gold and silver back then. I was a, you know, total gold bug, and, you know, watching all of those guys. And I never, ever took Bitcoin seriously. And it was completely off my radar until this degenerate mentioned it to me again. And, you know, I shitcoined a little bit in the beginning as I was trying to figure this out, but I quickly sort of honed in on Bitcoin as this is the fucking game changer here. This is the zero to one moment. All this other shit is noise. And I quickly sort of honed into that. So I'm always curious, like, you know, it takes an interesting type of, call it character or breed of human or whatever, to understand Bitcoin, particularly, you know, at the time where, you know, coming into it, whether it was 2017, 2018, like, I think more shitcoiners were minted during that period than any other period, obviously. But more importantly, more actual, what I call like the most important class of Bitcoin, in a sense, were minted. Like, sort of, you know, it was like, I call us kind of like the class of 2016, 17, 18, right? It's the, you know, we have come in, and whether it's you guys, whether it's, you know, GG, Breedlove, you know, we've sort of come out and produced all of this incredible work, which is now being picked up by, you know, the Sailors of the world and Peterson, et cetera. So we've sort of almost like this, I don't know, call it a Renaissance class or something like that. So talk me through, this is a long way of me asking you the question, and talk me through the breadcrumbs or maybe the seeds that were planted for each of you guys early on that, you know, helped you guys kind of hone in on Bitcoin as the thing, as opposed to all the other shit.
I'll start, because I think what I say might help lead Ben in a little bit. But I know, like, for me, a huge factor for me was the Noted podcast with Bitstein and Pierre Richard, because they were, you know, I was immediately struck by how intelligent those guys were. And when I first got into like crypto, right, I was just thirsty for as like, I was just devouring, like, I was just like, oh, this is incredible. This is going to change the world. And I got sucked into these communities of shitcoiners who really weren't interested in conversations beyond surface level. Like, they only wanted to talk about speculating on like these just worthless, totally liquid garbage tokens. And I wanted to go deeper. I was like, well, why is this valuable? Right? Like, what problems are we fixing here? Like, we're trying to fix the money. Cause I understood the economic side pretty well at that point. Like, I knew that we were just trending in this awful direction, you know, like a total fiat collapse and just total debt implosion. And I was already looking at things like, you know, $18 trillion in negative yielding debt or whatever it was at the time. And I remember just trying to dig deeper with these people. And I constantly was sort of finding myself the smartest guy in the room. And I knew that that is not a good place to be. So when I found Noted podcast, I was like, oh, these guys are way smarter than me. Like, they have spent way more time thinking about this. They reference all of this incredibly dense literature, and they're the kind of people that I want to like intellectually explore with. So I started kind of following Pierre on Twitter, and that led me into, you know, following more people on Bitcoin Twitter, along with a whole bunch of scammers. And I developed all of my own heuristics for sort of sorting through these people. Like, I figured out pretty quickly that Vinny Lingham was an idiot, right? And Kyle Torpy was worth following, and, like, you know, Mr. Hoddle was great. And then from there, I was able to develop relationships and really talk to these people on a serious intellectual level, where we hashed out the theoretics of this thing, and people like Pierre, you know, who's always very generous with his time, like JW Weatherman, mm-hmm. was hugely selfless with his time for me, in helping me talk through like literally every aspect of understanding Bitcoin and why it was so valuable, and so many other people, like too many for me to list. And so much so that I started a podcast just because I wanted to feed my selfish desire to have intellectual conversation with extremely smart people. And that was how Ben and I met each other.
Yeah. I came in unashamedly from Number Go Up. I mean, it's funny because I knew about Bitcoin like 2012 when it first showed up on Slashdot, and probably 2014 or 2015, the Silk Road stuff was going on. And I was like, oh man, I should buy some of this. Maybe I'll get some drugs on the internet. I don't know. And like, I ended up not buying any because they asked for my personal information. I was like, oh, I thought this shit was anonymous. So I kind of basically just forgot about it until Number went up in 2017. Started watching Andreas videos, started arguing with people on Reddit, and eventually found, you know, I eventually saw the smart people on Reddit were saying, you got to get on Twitter. Found Pierre Richard, and eventually found the podcast scene, and I found Colin's podcast, luckily. And it's funny because my Twitter journey is the same as the podcast journey, because I found that, you know, as you know, I started with like basically zero followers. I started with like a few people in my family, and it was like maybe 10 people. And I started commenting on people's things and just started talking. And the same thing happened with the podcast, where you know, if your ideas actually have merit, if you've actually done your research, people will listen and people will retweet it. And I reached out to Colin at one of his podcasts. He says, hey, just reach out to me if you ever want to chat. And he mm-hmm. had me on. And then, man, I don't know, man, a lot has happened since then. And like you said, yeah, it's really cool because the content that, you know, Alex, you and I and Colin are making are standing on the shoulders of giants like Pierre and Marty Bent and Stefan and all them too. So it all builds. And now, you know, now WTF was cited in the letter to the shareholders from the CT, Iceland?
The Norwegian guys. Norwegian, yeah.
Yeah,
so. I actually spoke to them this morning.
Oh, nice.
That was an incredible shout out, man. Like, honestly, that was exactly like what you just said, is, you know, all this incredible content has been produced by people who get it. But I guess I want to go deeper on this, is like, why do you think it was that you guys were attracted, for example, to work done like for example, Pierre's podcast, right? So most shitcoiners who are devout shitcoiners, they won't listen to Pierre. They'll be like, oh yeah, I don't get what these guys are talking about. They'll be like, oh yeah, I want to listen to fucking some monkey shilling me the next crypto that's going to go up 10,000% or something. You know what I mean? So it's like, there's genuinely a difference between people like yourselves and the majority of the monkeys, you know, following, you know, the scammers. Like, I mean, for fuck's sake, like you mentioned Vinny Lingham. He's a perfect example. What's he got? 100,000 followers. Like, how fucking dumb do you need to be to follow this guy? So like, what were the earlier ingredients that, you know, I guess inspired you to think deeper about this? Because that needed to be there before you just randomly stumbled onto Pierre and this thing.
Well, I could go way back. Like I did actually do just it. Recently on, well, I just recently talked about this with Daniel Princey on his podcast Once Bitten, where okay. I talked a little bit about like my childhood and like some of the things that mm-hmm. I've been through in life. And I don't have enough time to like sit here and recount all those things for you. But like, I've been through a lot of things in life that sort of pushed me away from blind faith and authority. But more immediately, like when I got into Bitcoin, I was really into trading penny stocks. And what you learn when you trade penny stocks is that 99% of everything is a scam. And even the stuff that's good to buy is still a scam. But like, if you know what you're doing and you do your homework and you pay attention to the right people, you know, who are not just trying to pump their bags, who are actually digging through financial reports and looking for certainly companies that have good pumpamentals, right? They might not necessarily have good fundamentals, but they're structured in such a way where, you know, like they're low float, they have no debt. Those are the types of companies that you look for, and you find people who are good at identifying those things. And then you like talk with them about why it might be a good purchase. And then, you know, a few months later, if you bought a bunch of shares at like 1/1000th of a penny. Maybe that company gets acquired, you know, maybe it's a shell that gets acquired by like some company that matters, and now it's worth like 10 cents and you just, you know, made like 1000x or something stupid. And it was sort of that background around that same time that I was really heavily involved in that, that I came across Bitcoin, and I noticed a lot of similarities with just about every shitcoin. And I was like, okay, all the smartest people in the room here are talking about Bitcoin. Why? Right? Because surely they must see Icon is so much better. Ethereum Classic, like that's going to go to the moon. Why are these guys Bitcoin only? And they, because clearly they've done the research and like these other guys haven't. And that has always kind of stood out to me. Like I've always made an effort to surround myself with deeper thinkers in life, like foregoing superficial friendships to find the people who are willing to ask why, even when it's uncomfortable or when it challenges conventional wisdom. Like a general acceptance of conventional wisdom is something that I've shunned from a pretty young age.
Yeah, there's some similarities there, and there's some vast differences in my side of the story. I would say, you know, just to distill it down, what really drew me to Bitcoin was my deep appreciation for technology and understanding and really trying to dig into how technology works. And sometimes I go back and try to find like those articles on Slashdot and you know, from 2012, 2013, and read through it and figure out why I missed it. Because I could tell that there was something there, but I could tell that I either wasn't smart enough to understand how Bitcoin worked at the time, because, you know, of all the cryptography and all that, I couldn't verify it. I was never a coder. But on top of that, like, would it work, right? Like, if you bought Bitcoin and held it from 2012, there was a serious risk that it would go to zero, right? And I looked at it and said, that's a really interesting idea, what I understood of it, which was very little, but I don't think it'll work. And then it was still around in 2014. I was like, oh, it looks like it's kind of still working. I should get into this. And I was like, oh, it's not anonymous. So it's not what I thought it was, or I don't know how to access it that way. And then in 2017, I was like, now it's still around and it keeps getting bigger. And why has that happened? And I had to answer that question for myself. And I was kind of in a Bitcoin information desert for a little while. I mean, I know he gets a lot of crap, but all I had was Andreas, and I could tell that he was very smart, and I could tell that there was definitely something there after watching, you know, 100 videos, but I couldn't find anything else. I mean, it was just traders on YouTube and Reddit. And that's how I got into the shitcoins too. I mean, man, that was a diversion for like 2 or 3 months. And then basically as soon as I found Pierre and Twitter, and I started listening to people that actually knew what they were talking about, that's where the similarities come back. Cause you can tell that there's a vast difference in the way that they talk about economics. And I started to realize that, you know, Bitcoin wasn't an economic phenomenon. It was a monetary revolution, potentially speaking. And that led me to realize that I didn't know enough about economics to even evaluate, you know, what these people were talking about on either side, on any of the sides. And that drove me to want to learn about Austrian economics. Long story short, Justin Moon had a great book club with Max Hillebrand, who thank you so much to Max for helping shepherd me and Tib and Zane. And that was where it was like, now I have this superpower of Austrian economics, and now I can really evaluate everything and see through all the bullshit from the Keynesian and everything else, you know?
Oh, real quick too, what he just mentioned made me think of something. Speaking of Justin Moon, like something that I did, I think it was like late 2018, maybe early 2019. I don't remember exactly. Justin Moon started what he called Biddle Bootcamp at the time. Now I think he calls it Mooniversity, but it was basically like an intermediate level Python programming course where you stepped through all of the theoretics of Bitcoin and how it works under the hood, and you built your own Bitcoin on top of Python. And that was huge for me, because it set me apart from so many of these other speculators that knew like next to zero about the technology. And suddenly, like, I understood these terms, like what a block header is and like how blocks are propagated across the network and what, you know, how cryptography actually works and all these types of things. And that was hugely influential in helping me kind of come to terms with how Bitcoin sets itself apart technologically from so many of these other tokens.
Yeah, because that course, doesn't it? It starts by building shitcoins, right? So for you first, exactly. Like start building Bitcoin with like out most of the ingredients that you need in order to make it work, and you
genius. You build shitcoins first, and you're like, okay, let's literally just make a token where we both create images, and then we like send them to each other via like email or whatever. And it's like, okay, yeah, I mean that could work as money, but like here are all the reasons that that's wrong. Right. And if I just control this database, then you have to come to me for permission to like let you trade your little image tokens around. And like it builds up to like why all of the technological innovations of Bitcoin were necessary to create a digital cash. And it sort of just completely dismantles so many of the technical mumbo jumbo that you hear spouted by shitcoiners.
Interesting. So I've never done that course, but that's like a interesting methodology, like almost like a little hero's journey in understanding the Bitcoin from its technical first principles, right? Would that be a good way in sort of framing it?
Yes.
Yeah,
totally.
I think one thing that Ben mentioned there is like, I know Andreas does get a lot of shit, and I've given him, you know, my fair amount of shit, but he was a beacon during that time. Like, but I've got to give him credit where credit's due is, you know, during 2017 and 2018, like he was one of the only voices, like Ben said, that actually spoke about Bitcoin's impact from a philosophical standpoint that kind of aligned with the things that I gave a fuck about personally as a human being. Not just, you know, I came to fucking make a smash and grab, killing, you know, on some sort of trade. Like there was something that was more deeply motivating to me. And I mean, whatever stupidities he's done, like he articulated that piece about Bitcoin really well. Like I personally, what's really interesting is I've actually never even listened to a single podcast from Pierre or Bitstein. So I missed out on that. My sort of push towards Bitcoin was actually listening to Giacomo and Jimmy on Tone Vase's fucking show a couple of times. And I don't know, I love Giacomo's work, and I was like, fuck, this guy is just brilliant. Like he's really intelligent, and he's fucking funny, yeah. And he gets it. And I think what else sort of around that time, I can't remember like what was some of the core ingredients, but I think Andreas was probably the main thing for me. And then I had a little bit of history in the past, obviously having been a gold and silver bug in 2011, 2012, where I'd done some, you know, reading on inflationary policy and how all of that works. And I've always had this anti-authoritarian bent about me. Like I've always hated what I call fiat authority, not natural authority. Because, you know, natural authority is something you earn, right? Fiat authority is something you just decree because you fucking said so. And that for me has always rubbed me the wrong way. Like I'm a big believer of competence as the precursor to natural authority, as opposed to you just saying that. And you know, that's got me in a fair bit of trouble in my life. But you know, Bitcoin sort of embodied all of that for me. And the first person who really articulated that well for me was Andreas. And then I think, like I said, do you know what actually also was a big one as well was Tone and Jimmy and everyone. They were the first guys to really promote Seyfertin's work, at least for me. So then I picked up Bitcoin Standard, and that you know, I had already read about the history of money from, I mean, not the greatest book, but still a good book, was Jack Weatherford's book. What's it called? I think it's called A History of Money or something like that. But it's a good enough book to sort of help you understand how money emerged from the beginning and sort of its journey along the way. And then Seyf obviously took that and put it in the context of Bitcoin. And, you know, but by that point, like, you know, this is sort of early 2018, like I was a fucking rabid Bitcoin and beating everyone over the head around me, you know, telling them to stop fucking shitcoining and everything like that. It was just an interesting time.
The point that you make about Andreas, I actually tweeted about this a few years ago, which is crazy to think that the time moves that quickly. But I pointed out that Andreas, in the nonsense of like 2016, 2017, like all the ICOs and just the total, just complete waves of nonsense washing over people all the time, like so much noise, Andreas was like this beacon of truth, right? And it just shows you how quickly, how rapidly the intellectual fabric of Bitcoin specifically evolved over that time period. That he, because Andreas didn't really change, right? But he went from being like this beacon of truth and knowledge to sort of like this clown that we all sort of poked fun at, because he wasn't really along for this ride of just this rapid development of this intellectual tapestry of Bitcoin. That happened through the most recent bear market. And I mean, it was just incredible. I mean, like we had all these new podcasts come on. We had some of the most incredible thinkers I've ever listened to in my entire life, like kind of coming on board and like Michael Saylor, right? Going from zero to hero really quickly because of the amount of new content that was coming out and the discussions that were happening.
He's one of the best examples.
Yeah.
So Saylor's one of the best examples of what, you know, it's like, you know, people are like, oh, you know, Saylor was the, you know, the kickstarting of the bull market. And in some ways that might be, you know, have some truth in it, but it wasn't really like, if you're thinking about cause and effect, it wasn't actually Saylor. It was the work that was done during the bear market from the diehards that didn't, you know, give up. I remember the amount of conferences I went to in 2018, like whether they were fintech conferences or tech conferences or capital raising conferences. And, you know, like particularly with Amber, like we raised our money in 2018, everyone thought I was a fucking lunatic. And, you know, I would have to not only sell them, like when I'd get up on stage to sell Amber to try and raise some capital, I'd first have to sell them on Bitcoin, which is this thing that's down 70% this year. and then sell them on this business that's apparently going to, you know, help people get into this asset that's apparently failing and dying. But, you know, I would sit there and talk about how this thing was, you know, going to transform the world. And, you know, a couple of crazy people came on that journey early on and backed me and backed what we're doing at Amber. And, you know, I just find it funny now to think about those times when, you know, like I would really polarize the room. And, you know, there was people who genuinely just thought I was a fucking nut job. But people who would come up to me afterwards and be like, look, you're sort of the only person I've ever heard talking about anything to do with Bitcoin or this whole, at that time, the buzzword, you know, that was really emerging was blockchain. They're like, that talks about, you know, anything in the blockchain space that makes any sense. And I was like, yeah, because blockchain is fucking bullshit. And Bitcoin is the revolution here. And it's just, it's funny to think now how far we've come in such a short period of time, right? It's barely been 6 months that, you know, we were still sort of positioned or considered as crazy. And now like we're almost living in a completely different world, which is, I guess, one of the interesting side effects of what I would say is the beginning of the bull market.
Yeah, it's funny because you kind of asked earlier, like, have you seen, you know, friends or people, you know, the Uber driver or whatever asking about Bitcoin? And I have had a few friends reach out to me because I have been outspoken about it in the past. But one of the things that changed for me rather than them over the past 6 months is I've de-risked it myself. So I used to be like, oh, hey, like, I know it sounds crazy, but I don't do that anymore. I'm just like, yeah, I'm into Bitcoin. I quit my fiat job and now I work on Bitcoin full time. Like, this is what's important. Like, get on board, dude.
That reminds me of a framing that I've used recently. So I was on this guy's podcast and it was actually in November last year, just as things were starting to heat up. I don't think Bitcoin had broken the all-time high at that stage, but, you know, so this guy is sort of, he's actually a football player from Australia. He's, you know, relatively famous. He's retired now and he runs a podcast about investing. And I was on there and the framing I used to him, I said, look, you know, a couple of years ago, one may have made the argument that it's risky to be involved in Bitcoin or risky to have some Bitcoin. I said, now the only argument that counts is it's risky not to be. And the framing I kind of gave him was, I said, like, imagine you're a CFO at a business or someone who's managing finances of any sort. Do you want to be the only idiot that was left behind who didn't put some of the allocation in Bitcoin? Because I said, that's the question now. I said, it's no longer, you know, were you the idiot who gambled on this Bitcoin thing at a time when it was untrusted? And kind of, Ben, you touched on this earlier, is like, you know, back in 2012, yeah, you know, it took a specific kind of person who was probably partially deranged to really believe in Bitcoin as being able to do something. But, you know, by sort of 2015, 2016, you know, 2017, you know, that question sort of went out. And particularly, you know, 2019, 2020, like the kind of madness that's happened in the last 12 months, you'd have to be a complete moron or completely ignorant of it to not have some sort of Bitcoin exposure. And I think that's a really interesting, it was actually in one of our pitch decks at Amber from a while ago that, you know, I kind of talked about how that question is sort of it's a 0-to-1 question almost. It's like a night and day question, is when that sort of switch flips, you know, we're going to start to see something extraordinary happen. And I actually think we're only just scratching the surface of that switch flipping. So I think that's just an important distinction for people, is like the game theory has changed at this stage. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
I mean, I agree. I think it used to be you had to be a little crazy to be in Bitcoin. And now, you know, you had to definitely be somebody who could extrapolate into the future. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that it was my deep appreciation for technology and how it scales and changes and evolves and fills to fit our needs and, you know, in exponential fashion. I remember being very young, like 10, 11 years old. And I was very lucky to have family members who understood computers. And I had a computer in my room when I was that young. And in the early 90s, that was not, you know, kids didn't have their own computers, right? And I used to be playing on my computer, or when I was in college, I had, these like Palm Pilot type devices before iPhones were around, and people thought I was weird for carrying around a little computer in my pocket. I think that's changing. You don't have to be the crazy person anymore. My not crazy friends are starting to get interested. And then I think the next thing is the not crazy CEOs, you know, I mean, Elon Musk is the crazy CEO, but the not crazy ones pay attention to what he's doing. And I think the stampede is still coming. I think it takes time for a lot of those CEOs to move on it. And maybe the crazy countries are coming next, you know, the Irans of the world or whatever, the Venezuelas, right? We're kind of already starting to see that happen a little bit. You know, I don't think Iran actually has it on their central bank balance sheets. I've spoken to people in Iran and Iraq and stuff, but I think it's coming, you know. I don't know. It comes in waves, man, these fractal patterns.
Well, the other thing too, I think by the time like we were closing in on the end of the bear market, the most recent bear market, we were sort of at critical mass for the non-conventional, intellectually curious, intellectually honest thinkers coming into this space and saying, okay, I get it. I'm on board. I'm buying as much as I can. I'm ready. And then we had this really interesting phenomenon of the emergence. And all of us were nobodies, right? Like, let's be honest. Like, just about everybody in Bitcoin, we're just nobodies. Like, we're not famous. Many of us don't want to be famous. Like, we don't have any intellectual clout. We don't have all of these fancy pedigrees. We don't have hardly any of us had written, you know, New York Times bestsellers. There might have been like a few here and there, but for the most part, they were very fringe. And then we had this interesting phenomenon about a year ago where the Ray Dalios, the Michael Saylors, the Elon Musks, and you know, you could probably name a few others, come in. And these guys are non-traditional, non-conventional thinkers, but they're huge, hugely influential. And they carry massive pedigrees or huge pools of capital, like in the case of Ray Dalio or like in BlackRock's case. And they come in, and yes, they're non-conventional, and they came in at kind of like what I said was the tail end of the critical mass of non-conventional thinkers, really kind of coming to grips with this thing. And now they've bought intellectual cover for all of these people who are just followers, right? Because most people are just followers. And the worst of the followers just follow the other followers. But there's this group of followers who follow the more non-conventional thinkers, right? The Ray Dalios. And now they suddenly have like this intellectual cover to hide behind and say, well, I mean, Ray Dalio is doing it. So I'm going to put 5% of my net worth into Bitcoin and see what happens. And now we're watching sort of like these incremental ladder step up from here as that intellectual cover has been established and more people are taking positions and the rest of the world just follows.
Which is hilarious because about a year ago, I was saying, man, I think Ray Dalio is next. And by the way, Ray Dalio, he still doesn't completely understand Bitcoin. He knows that there's a there, but he hasn't fully gone down the rabbit hole. And he's admitted that in public. So even he's just kind of starting to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, I don't know. I agree with that. But I think Ray Dalio for me personally is a beneficiary of the existing system. You know, it's not in his best interest to want Bitcoin to actually emerge, because actually, you know, Bitcoin breaks the their hedge fund model. Bitcoin breaks a lot of the need. Like, you know, Parker wrote a really beautiful piece in the Bitcoin Times. I don't know if you guys read it, but the, you know, Bitcoin is the great definancialization. It is a fundamental fucking, you know, atomic bomb for that whole industry. So, you know, the Dalios and those guys are just...
For sure, you know, but Ray Dalio wrote the piece called Paradigm Shifts, and he says...
I know, and that's the thing, and he doesn't get it. I was literally, you just pulled the words out of my mouth.
Right.
So I wrote a piece on his, like, work about a year and a bit ago called Correcting Dalio, and I basically pulled apart one of his pieces where he talks about, you know, like, you know, money and debt cycles and this and that, and where he talks literally in there about paradigm shifts. And I'm like, fuck, this guy is talking about this shit, but he just doesn't fucking seem to get it. Like, he just can't add the two and two together at the end of it, which is so glaringly fucking obvious. Like, another person who reminds me of that is, and you know, to a lesser degree, is not a beneficiary like Dalio of the existing system, but is Matt Ridley as well. Like, he did a podcast with Jordan Peterson actually recently. And they basically pointed out all the shit that Bitcoiners talk about and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, the word that was basically missing from there was, you know, Bitcoin as a solution. They talk about sort of innovation as a solution and free markets as a solution to problems and, you know, and entrepreneurialism and all this sort of stuff. But it kind of all reminds me of fucking, you know, basically, you know, mental masturbation until you sort of provide the solution piece, which is Bitcoin. And I don't know what it is, why they can't understand it. Because I mean, even Matt Ridley has actually been on Stefan Levera's podcast. And I remember after I found that out, I was like, fuck, I've got to listen to this. And he didn't seem to get it. Like, he's sitting there talking about free markets, talking about all this stuff, but can't put the last two and two together. But again, like, you know, he's probably different to Dalio in that sense, because he's not a direct beneficiary of the existing fiat system. So you know, the motivations might be different, and, you know, maybe the capacity to grasp it, you know, may also be different. But it's an interesting thing. I want to bring up Peterson here, actually, because I know, Colin, you recently wrote, obviously, that piece, which was, you know, inspired by some of Peterson's work. And you mentioned before the call that you've been doing a bit of digging. Like, I've always thought that Peterson, out of everyone, for me, like, in this whole, you know, fucking whatever they call themselves, intellectual dark web, for me is like really cringy, because I think most of the people in and around that space are fucking morons. But for me, Peterson has always come off as, most importantly, other than intelligent, because he's genuinely intelligent, but he comes off, to me, what's most important is authentic. Like, he actually deeply cares. And, you know, he's got a mission behind his message. And for me, that's always been profound. And that's why I've always been drawn to his work, you know, for many years now, you know, long before he was fucking famous. Like, you know, I've sort of always been drawn to his work, and I've really enjoyed it. I read Maps of Meaning fucking years and years ago. You know, I read 12 Rules for Life when it came out, and I've loved his work. And I think for me, out of everyone, he's sort of the one that if I had to put money on out of all the so-called intellectuals today, that is going to appreciate Bitcoin to a deeper degree. But I'd be curious to hear both, you know, your thoughts on that, and then maybe some of the work that you guys have been doing and thinking about in relation to Peterson stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like you, I think I first kind of discovered Peterson when he was starting to blow up on like random YouTube videos, when the YouTube algorithm was still suggesting him, and they would be just filmed lectures of his that he was giving at Boston University or whatever it was. And he'd be talking about these really abstract concepts, but in a way that you don't typically hear fiat academics speaking, like you said, very truthfully. And that's actually one of the rules that he mentions in his book, the 12 Rules for Life or whatever it is, where it's to go to great lengths, right, to avoid untruths, or to avoid telling white lies in your everyday life, and to be wholly truthful in everything that you do, because it's the only way, you know, that you can really make any progress as a person. And the fact that you're doing everyone around you a disservice if you're not honest with them, like fully and totally all the time. And it's that, you know, even if like you don't have to agree with everything Peterson says, I don't. But it you can at least admire that he's extremely brilliant, and you can admire that to a certain degree he's incredibly truthful. And that's a rare thing today in the fiat academic world. And I love what he talks about in 12 Rules for Life, where he talks about the Gulag Archipelago, and he talks about Man's Search for Meaning by Dr. Frankel. Those are both two tremendous books. And they talk about these building foundations of small lies, right? Creates this foundation in society that lays the groundwork for totalitarian social order. Because if you allow yourself to stomach tons and tons of little lies, right, you see how it can build up just this nonsense and bureaucracy and rent seeking and total rejection of truth in society. And we see it all around us. We see it in so many ways. You don't even have to get political with it. Like, you see it in bureaucracy. You think bureaucracy makes sense? Go spend like a month trying to wade through red tape to accomplish anything. It's soul crushing. It's horrible. And people will tell you, oh, this is just how it has to be. You know, this is just what we have to do. And people believe that. They believe that because they are willing to stomach that lie. They push that little bit of bile that comes up in their throat when they tell themselves that in their head, and they swallow it. And they say, oh, no, this is fine. This is normal. And then that extends to like, it goes all the way back to like, oh, you know, inflation is fine. Wait as long as you can to get married. Don't have children. Go to college. Take out a loan. Buy a house. Like, there's all of this nonsense that we tell ourselves in society. And it lays this intellectual framework for just total rejection of truth. And it creates chaos. Go read Ayn Rand's We the Living. Like, you'll see what it's like in a society that rejects truth and just sort of tries to make every waking moment and all of its energy devote to trying to cope with these fake realities.
And I think he embraces that chaos, and he also, in order to identify those lies, those small lies that can build up to, you know, mountainous problems in our society, he's such a first principles thinker, because he'll take a concept or a topic that you've heard about 100 times and you've heard every take on it, and then he'll just break it down to the lowest common denominator and build it back up. And you have to have critical thinking and first principles skills that are, you know, of epic proportion to do what he does. And I think that's why it's clear, you know, and I have a little bit of inside information here, that I know that he has the ear of some very smart Bitcoiners. And I think it's inevitable that he'll come to realize that, you know, to accomplish a lot of the, you know, the, I don't want to say goals, but the maybe the vision for how we can improve society and dispel with some of those lies, he's going to realize that Bitcoin is such a powerful tool, a powerful weapon against those lies. And it's just very clear to me. I mean, even Eric Weinstein, I don't mean to get off of Peterson at all, but at the same time, like Eric identifies as well that the central bank tyranny is the real fight in the world. And mm-hmm, and I think mm-hmm. it's very clear that we're seeing a kind of a turning of the tide of these great minds. And I think, you know, it's we're still at the precipice.
Also,
very true.
Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Colin. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, man.
I was just going to say I was just going to reiterate a point basically about, I think, who says this? I think it's I forgot his name now. I know he calls Peterson the cheerleader, like, you know, save the cheerleader, save the world. And I think Peterson's a very, very important domino. Each year I do a random prediction, well, at least for as long as I've been on Twitter, which is, you know, 3 years, but I do a random prediction. And this year, like, my prediction was, on the 1st of January, I was like, three important people to get into Bitcoin this year are going to be Peterson, Tony Robbins, and Elon Musk. And I said, you know, they're sort of three important dominoes that will really put Bitcoin in front of the mainstream, but not just directly because they said it, but because they're an important domino effect to the people sort of around them who, you know, it almost comes back to what you guys were discussing before about, you know, listening to the smartest person in the room and asking yourself, why is this person sort of getting it? And I think, you know, those three personalities for me are incredibly important when I think about, you know, the influence they have in their individual circles. So I guess, you know, Peterson for me being, you know, the most authentic, probably intellectual of modern society, like, you know, I find him incredibly authentic. You know, if he really remains honest and authentic and grasps and understands Bitcoin, you know, those around him are going to, you know, they're either going to do it or they're going to make fools of themselves, which is an interesting motivator in and of itself.
You know, even as that happens, it takes time for that information to percolate out from these great thinkers to others and have, you know, I mean, somebody, you know, very prominent like Joe Rogan could come on the show tomorrow and say, hey, I've dropped all the things that I'm doing and I'm focusing on Bitcoin now. And, you know, all of his followers won't instantly become Bitcoiners, right? So it will take time for them to, you know, process and assimilate all this, the information that Bitcoin has and all the content that, you know, all of these amazing people have been creating that we've been talking about. But it'll take time to percolate down to the people that that even do follow them on a diehard kind of way.
It will.
I was going to say earlier also the other thing about Peterson's work. And so for me, it was a combination of Peterson's talking about ordering of chaos in conjunction with Gigi's writing on Bitcoin as time, where he actually, Gigi is such an incredible thinker, man. Like the way he orchestrated, what would you call it? Like explained this concept of proof of work is ordering of chaos, right? Because you have these nonces, right? These random numbers used only once that are, they create order from chaos. And Peterson talks a lot about this. He talks about the logic and the work necessary to create order from chaos and this being a necessary building block in societies to make society a better place. And how there's so many structures like in the past that have done this, and they're almost always man-made structures, right? And they function oftentimes, they don't scale because they function through the arm of like a government,
through the state, or they function, you know, like through religion, and they create order out of chaos. And like, this is what I believe the Bible does. And I wrote about this in my recent article, Wisdom and Law, where I talk about how, you know, to create order from chaos, like you have to do work, you have to measure, you have to label, and you have to organize, and then you have to assign those things values, like relative to each other. And then you have to take those values and you have to plug them into algorithms to create order from the chaos, because there's just these infinite variables floating around in the ether, and you have to do work to measure them and label them and put them in an algorithm.
And that order itself has to then percolate throughout society. It's not an overnight process as well, even if it's a well-designed, you know, order of some kind that is coming out of that chaos. It can't just happen immediately.
And I have a feeling that Gigi's work, that article in particular, I think this is probably true based on the fact that I think Peterson retweeted it or whatever. I have a feeling it was the section on order and chaos, because Peterson talks about this so much. And I don't know if Gigi drew inspiration there from some of Peterson's work. It's likely that he did, but I don't know. You know, he can't put words in his mouth. I tweeted the other day that Bitcoin is the first man-made autonomous system that creates order from chaos. It's the first one that's ever existed that wasn't like a sovereign state or like a church or, you know, pick your poison.
Well, I guess that's an important piece, like, because you've got so many layers or metaphors for Bitcoin turning, you know, chaos into order, you know, as this. I don't know if you've read some of GT's earlier work. So he did, he actually did a piece for Bitcoin Times Edition 2, which touches on that, you know, Bitcoin from the viewpoint of entropy, and also proof of life. But me, Gigi, and Breedlove had a really long discussion about this point exactly, on actually my first episode of Wake Up, where I had a guest on. So the first one we did was that Cosmic Call where I fucked up the audio. But it was, you know, we sort of discussed that idea of order, chaos, entropy, and they sort of all tie into each other as this, I guess, you know, getting a little bit cosmic here is, you know, other than maybe Bitcoin, I think the other organic mechanism for turning chaos into order is actually life itself. I think life itself is an anti-entropic yes. force that seems to permeate existence. And what it does is it takes chaos and transforms it into some, you know, some form of order. And you know, it does so for a period of time, and then it, you know, it continues on, which I think is such an interesting analogy or metaphor for Bitcoin as a living creature, I guess, in a sense, or a living
organism. It's the first man-made creation of life.
It's I guess depending on the definition of life. But yeah, I think right. Gigi makes a strong case for it in the article Proof of Life, for it being a form of life.
Right. In the sense that life, as you said, creates order from chaos, right? Because all life is just non-entropic variables are arranged in the algorithms that allow you to exist, right? I mean, and that's why I make the argument. And, you know, I understand plenty of people don't agree with me on this, but like, that's why I make the argument for intelligent design in that article, is because I think it sort of speaks to this deductive nature of labeling and ordering chaos, right? It requires some sort of logic and work. To me, I mean, you know, that's pretty irrefutable.
Interesting. Let's pull on, sorry, you go first, Ben, and then let's pull on that thread.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, it's like humans are the intelligent design of God, and then Bitcoin is the intelligent design of humans. It's like layered.
So let's pull on that thread. So talk to me about your interpretation then of an intelligent designer. Like, what is that for you?
Well, so it to me, right, you know, you study biology,
life seems like an enigma, right? It seems almost impossible. Because the universe is trying to kill you 24/7, right? There are all of these things working against life, making life impossible. And there was sort of like this unbelievably coincidental moment in space-time where life just emerged. And it may have never happened. If you're assuming that it just happened randomly, right? It could have never happened because the infinite entropic variables, as I call it, arrange themselves in just such a way that life emerged. And here we have this thing that just defies all of the logic of randomness that comes forward, and it's beautiful and it's planned and it works. And yeah, it's not perfect, and yeah, it's got its flaws, and yeah, it has to work within the confines of physical reality. But it's order within chaos. That's all life is, right? So, you know, if Bitcoin is order within the chaos of all of these random numbers, right? And that was intentional design on behalf of Satoshi, he had to recognize that there was chaos there that could be harnessed and ordered in order to produce, you know, this functional thing that sort of lived. It took a lot of work and a lot of time for him to assign and label and verify all of those variables and put them into the algorithms that made the system work the way it did.
Yeah, and it's funny because I come from more of an agnostic point of view, but it's pretty undeniable what Colin just laid out, both that, you know, life itself is miraculous, however you want to attribute the meaning of that word, and then also that Bitcoin miraculously works is almost just as hard to believe, and yet here we both are, both humans and Bitcoin, and that itself is profound.
Yeah, that they both exist. I guess. I mean, I kind of maybe from, you know, my having played around with sort of complexity and, you know, ideas of duality and stuff like that, I guess, you know, I would question the idea of the possibility of a lack of order with the existence of chaos, because I think they fundamentally need each other. So I actually don't find it as strange that order exists within chaos, because chaos also exists within order, and you sort of can't have one without the other. What do you think about that point?
Well, so I don't disagree with you. So you're taking more of a Taoist approach there. You're talking about like the yin and the yang, the balance. And I don't agree with you. However, because of the nature of entropy, it always requires work to produce order. Mm-hmm. Order doesn't occur naturally. And it, you know, just look around my room right now. I need to do some work to put this place back in order. And that requires logic on my behalf. I have to say, okay, this goes here and I put it there, right? It doesn't just happen on its own. It doesn't just happen amid the chaos. It's not random. Order is not random. It's by its nature, it's the opposite of randomness.
Yes. So in the absence of order, then what happens then?
That is chaos by definition.
Okay. And then what is then... is chaos, like, how do you view chaos then? Is it a process? Is it a destination? Is it a thing?
Entropy, randomness. Entropy, you know, you can define entropy a whole number of different ways, but I like to just think of it as like a messy room. You know, like as you go about your day and you might be a little lazy and throw that t-shirt on the floor, well, you're creating entropy. And entropy is building throughout your room until you do work to put it back in order. And order always requires work of some kind being performed on the natural entropy that occurs, you know, in all aspects of matter.
But didn't the chaos also require some work? So the, you know, it requires work for you to throw your shirt on the ground or something.
Well, it requires energy, certainly. I mean, like the universe is filled with potentially infinite energy, right? Just constantly expanding. And that's sort of the source of this entropy. I mean, if we're talking about, you know, we can boil it down to talking about a bedroom and how it gets messy, but on a cosmic scale, right, this is happening all around us all the time in the universe. It's just this expanding, infinitely entropic burst of energy and matter.
Okay. Have you read any of Hawking's work or not?
I've read a little bit of him.
Okay. Because I guess there's the idea of randomness being actually the ingredient that created order in the first place. So in the absence of randomness, you have just nothingness, basically. So
I think that's just absurd. That
randomness introduces.
I think really? That's just absurd. Yeah, and I think the way, based on the way that I explained that, I think it's pretty reasonable to understand like why that's absurd. I mean, order doesn't just naturally emerge in chaos. It just doesn't happen. There's too many variables. It's too entropy expands. It doesn't limit itself. It doesn't create order within itself via its own mechanisms. It requires outside work to label, identify, measure, and assign those variables into particular order to produce order.
At the same time, I kind of see what you're saying, Alex, like, because I've always thought that like the quantum mechanic fluctuations of electrons around a proton around the nucleus of an atom, where they must travel in every single path, and they're neither in any one location or in all locations at the same time, all at the same time, that they sort of render the universe because they create this electron probability cloud. And it's from that chaos that you get the order of the atom. And then the building blocks come all the way up to molecules. And
But even the nature of an atom, it's fundamentally impossible in terms of randomness, right? I mean, it's impossible. It shouldn't exist. But it does.
Why?
Well, because it's shaped by the rules of the universe, so to speak, right?
Because, I mean, you know, forgive me, it's been a long time since I've taken chemistry, but the nature of an atom, like it shouldn't happen. Like it shouldn't happen. You have all of this space in between, you know, the protons and the electrons, and they align themselves in just such a way to produce these elements and these complex chemical compounds. It shouldn't happen. Randomness should just scatter those particles.
Yeah, but you could say, so if I gave you the example of a free market though, so that actually sounds like a Keynesian argument, is that you need some sort of some sort of decree or some sort of directionality for the market, whereas a market is this random thing that seems to converge upon what functions.
Markets are not random. Markets are not random, but markets are calculated action taken by an entrepreneur to satisfy the ends of the consumer. That is not random. That is order. That is order produced via work. The entropy.
It's localized order though, dude. Not on a macro scale. Like it converges on macro order because there is an attempt. But in order for it to be global order, it would require some all-seeing, all-knowing entity to know that this is what this entrepreneur should do at this particular point in time. So it's a chaotic event. Markets are a chaotic event that seems to find order through the process of discovery.
And I totally agree with what you're saying. Like I don't disagree with that at all. The only reason that we cannot centrally plan markets is because nobody has enough information. If there was an entrepreneur who had the correct information to centrally plan all markets across space and time, I believe that it could be done. That's actually the problem being solved by the individual entrepreneur, on an individual basis across time and space. They're doing it because they're acting on the information that they have available within their own locality.
Yeah, but I think that's the statement about an entrepreneur being able to get all the information and everything. I think that is a physical impossibility, because then you sort of get, you actually remove the necessary chaos through which order has to emerge. And I don't think one can exist without the other.
We're talking about higher orders of existence here. So boil it down to like a program, right? A program that's written for a specific purpose. That program can't exist on a higher order, right? Because that the higher order level of organization happened by the programmer, right? That program can't recognize itself. It can't do anything other than its function, right? So if we're talking about, I understand that in our perception and our physicality, the idea of this omniscience where you could centrally plan markets is an impossibility, right? And I certainly not sitting here suggesting that one of us, you know, one among us is smart enough and wise enough to centrally plan the economies and do it successfully. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that this potential of intelligent design, which I think is irrefutable, could exist on a higher order than this order that we live in from moment to moment. And to think about this, you know, you have to get into this concept of time existing, you know, outside of the moment to moment in which we experience it, sort of on like more so like string theory in a way. Because the idea of omniscience and omnipresence is really difficult to consider, right? I mean, but that is what the Bible says, right? The Bible says that the creator is omniscient and omnipresent, and it within this order, right?
Well, so are quantum mechanics and relativistic time and space. So for what it's worth, those are just as hard to consider.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, me and Jimmy Song had a debate about this actually when we did the Preachers podcast. And, you know, I was putting forth the idea that, you know, in the absence of an intelligent creator, I think we get the same outcome, you know, in terms of, you know, the complex, chaotic process creating an order of its own is, I think, to me, very plausible, because complexity does something. There's an interesting book I'd recommend called The Revolutionary Phenotype from Jean-Francois Garapin. He talks about, he's got a very elegant model about, you know, sort of the emergence of life and DNA having come from RNA, and then RNA having sort of emerged as a revolutionary phenotype for proteins, and then proteins having emerged from, you know, sort of the quantum state, and sort of how those layers interact. But it's an interesting discussion. I don't think we're going to get to the bottom of the existence of life on this podcast. Maybe not just yet. We'll need a part two at least.
No, I would just say that, you know, you can put as much entropy as you want into a box and shake it up, but it's never going to produce order, right? Even if we're getting into complex quantum mechanics and theoretical physics and all of those types of things, at the end of the day, what you're essentially looking at is a system that ordered chaos. One way or another, however it happened, like regardless of whatever the underlying theoretical physics are, you have order produced from chaos. And I think if you examine that from a first principles perspective, you know, chances are that was done via work from some entity.
Need to somehow work gauge theory into that, Colin.
Yeah, I'm working on it.
Yeah, it's not finished until you've got some gauge theory.
It'll sum on top.
Cool. Interesting. I'm gonna do some thinking on this myself, because I think that, you know, work is a constant. So, you know, chaos is in the process of doing work. But anyway, I need to give this some thought, and there's a bit of fucking noise behind me, so I don't want to give people a messier podcast. Is there any other threads we want to pull on before we wrap this baby up?
Ben?
I don't think so.
Maybe, what about just a quick rundown of what you guys are doing with WTF happened in 2020? Is that like a joke, or is that you guys actually doing something there?
Oh man, as soon as like those charts started coming out about like negative oil prices and like, you know, $10 trillion being printed and stuff, we got so many messages on Twitter. It was like, you guys got to do What the Fuck Happened 2020. And we like immediately went and looked for the domain. It was taken. So we were like, we were like, oh, well, what are you going to do? And about 2 months ago, a Bitcoiner who I'm not sure if he wants his name out there, he can reach out to me if he does. I'll give him some credit. He reached out to me and he's like, I have the domain. And I was like, oh, sweet. Can I buy it off you? He's like, no, I'll just give it to you. And I ended up tipping him some LN sats anyway. But he gave us the domain. He just transferred it right over. And now we're starting to collect some charts. And it's funny because Colin and I were just talking about it the other day. And we were like, oh, this chart is awesome. But it's more of a 2008. Maybe we need another. Because there's all these like incredible like monetary events that have happened in the last 5 decades, and almost each one you could probably do one from the 1989 stock boom, and from the dot-com boom in 2008. But 2008 is a big one too. But we're gonna try to get some stuff together and get to what WTF happened in 2020 up. But it's hard because some of that stuff is still unfolding, you're trying to show an inflection point in the data. You kind of have to have some prehistory and some context that afterwards. So we're still playing with it.
We experiment with this on the Twitter a little bit. Like we've done a pretty good job protecting the meme on the Twitter. Like occasionally I have like moments of weakness and I'll retweet like something about Bitcoin or something, but for the most part, we don't give away the answer, right? We kind of just keep asking the question, and I try to do that as much as possible. And we experiment with the Twitter where like occasionally we'll be like, oh, by the way, what happened in 2008, and post like just the other day, posted a chart of rise in male virginity, like up to like a third of the average male is a virgin by the time he's like 30 or something like that. And that was an inflection point that happened following 2008. I can't remember the exact number. It might have been less than that, but and people blame all kinds of stuff, dude. They blame Tinder, they blame Facebook, they blame cultural phenomenons, and these are all the same types of explanations around second order effects that we see in around the 1971 talking point. So it's obvious that there's still a lot of education that needs to be done there. And I think if we continue to push this meme, I think that we might have found like a really powerful format for asking questions, just to get people to sort of wake themselves up, if not wake themselves up, like just sort of peek out from behind the wool on their eyes, right? To sort of just ask the question, like, hey, what happened in 2008? And most people don't know the answer. Like, that's the honest truth.
Right. And that whole website finding that data for WTF happened in 1971 was a wake up to me. Cause I couldn't believe that this data was just staring so many people in the face and nobody said, maybe we broke the money, right? So just, to take a nod to your podcast, and we hope that, it's helped red pill people that there is a problem with the broken money, even if they don't follow our trail of breadcrumbs to Bitcoin, which we have really tried to kind of make that path pretty clear for people to see in the forest. But we're trying to also preserve the meme as well. But yeah, if anybody's watching this and you have any, WTF data, 1971, 2008, 2020, please feel free to reach out to us and we'll try to get it up in there.
Absolutely. I think, that's I'd be curious to see what the the one that you mentioned about virgins, like what the correlation it would be with the rise of like Pornhub and shit like that. I bet there's like some really, really strong data there. But the monetary system. What a strange beast.
Debasing our society.
Exactly. Literally. All right, gents, let's wrap this up. Thank you so much for jumping on for another really good discussion. Can you quickly let everyone know where they can find you both? Obviously WTF happened in 1971 is the site, but you guys personally, where they can find you?
Yep, and we have the Twitter for that too, the @WTF1971 with an underscore in there. And then you can just reach out to me on Twitter or Telegram. I my DMs are always open. I always want to have a chat. I always say that, but hit me up.
Yeah, Ben's at Mr. Cool BP, and I'm at Heavily RMC on Twitter.
Heavily RMC. Okay, sweet. All right, boys. Thank you so much. And we will surely catch up. Who knows? Maybe in Miami, maybe somewhere else in some fucking citadel. Who knows?
All right, Alex. Thank you.
Good talking to you, man.